Four summers ago, I drove through Birmingham, Alabama, on my way back to seminary after a year of living in Washington, D.C., serving All Souls Church, as Helena mentioned. I parked my car across the street from 16th Street Baptist Church, the church known as the Organizing Center for the Civil Rights Movement in Birmingham in the early 1960s. The church that had been bombed by white supremacists in 1963, killing four little girls as they prepared for Sunday school. And as we talked about with the children before, in May of 1963, the segregation and racist violence in Birmingham had gotten so bad that it was a rare weekend that one or two members of the black community were not killed by the all-white police force led by Eugene Bull Connor. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., then only 34 years old himself, arrived in Birmingham that spring, prepared for 3 months of protests, intending to fill the jails with protesters. But as we said before, when he was arrested and thrown into solitary confinement on Good Friday and became incommunicado, members of the black community were too afraid of losing their jobs to be willing to march. And so while Dr. King was writing his now famous letter from a Birmingham jail on scraps of toilet paper and newspaper with a smuggled-in pencil, the civil rights movement leaders on the outside were struggling to drum up support. When Dr. King got out of jail, the movement leaders were almost ready to give up. But then the children showed up. And as they should have, the adult leaders debated fiercely whether children should be allowed to protest, much as we do today when we consider whether children should come on protests and marches with us. The police were unrelentingly violent to protesters in those days, and the movement leaders didn't know if they would be any better with the children. But Dr. King believed that the demonstrations allowed children to develop a sense of their own stake and their own freedom. The young people were willing, but they were afraid. It was hard to come to grips with, student protester Washington Booker said. We knew the police to be torturers and murderers. And the idea was to voluntarily submit yourself to be taken away with them. The young people were afraid, but the young people were willing. And so they marched. They faced violence and arrest, fire hoses and German shepherds, days in sweltering temporary jails away from their families, and unsure of what would come next. Now, I'm sure this story is familiar to many people in this room. It was complex. Dr. King and the other organizers faced harsh criticism for allowing children to be endangered. And as we all know, the battle for freedom lasted well beyond May 10th, 1963. Yet while I have known the broad outlines of this story my entire life, somehow I never fully understood until I actually went to Birmingham that most of the protesters were school-aged children, many aged 13 or 14, some as young as 6. So I was moving across country, so I had two cats in the back of my car as I sat outside the 16th Street Baptist Church that day. And the temperature was nearing 90 degrees outside, so I knew I couldn't stay long. I set my watch for 15 minutes and cracked the windows and told my cats that I would be back soon. Because diagonally across from the intersection of 16th Street Baptist Church is Kelly Ingram Park, the infamous site where many of the children have been attacked. Have any of you been down there to 16th Street Baptist or to Kelly Ingram Park? Okay, a couple. Today, the park is home to a series of memorials to the civil rights movement, and to that march in particular. As I stepped into the park, I noticed a walking loop that would take me through several large sculptures that paid tribute to those children's marches. First, you come to a model jail cell with metal statues of children gripping the bars and looking out forlornly at you. Continuing on, you pass a statue of a fire hose on a stand, chest high. It sort of looks like a machine gun. And the machine gun hose stands alone, It's not until you get close to it, it's not until actually you get behind it, as if you were shooting water from it, that you notice that it's pointing towards a stone wall. Crouched against the wall are two bronze figures of children, backs to the machine gun fire hose as if trying to protect themselves from the blast. If you keep walking, you soon find yourself between two walls set closely together and rising high above you. On your left, the torsos of two snarling metal German shepherds seem to leap out of the wall, eyes level with yours, uncomfortably close. And on your right, a third massive dog rears up at your throat, sharp teeth and crazed, vicious eyes. They're alarmingly alive. This part of the walk would be scary enough if the statues of the dogs were life-size, but the dogs are extra large, twice the size of the biggest German shepherd I've ever seen, and their gnashing teeth are dangerously close to your face as you're trapped between the two close walls rising insurmountably high above you. At first, I thought the dogs must have been extra large to make the sculpture seem more powerful. But as I climbed back into my car, heart still beating rapidly, I remembered that the people being attacked by the German shepherds were not grown adults like me. Many of them were children. Children so small that they must have found themselves at eye level with the rearing German shepherds. The statues weren't extra large, it was that the protesters were extra small. There's a saying that courage is fear that has said its prayers. Courage is fear that has said its prayers. These children were courageous, but these children were afraid. Each member of the Black community was in danger while simply walking through the streets of the segregated Birmingham at that time from the police and from the KKK. And the police and the KKK were often the same people at that time. They were afraid, and yet they decided to walk together for freedom, knowing that they would be attacked on the way, knowing that they could not keep themselves safe in jail. And they were children. The children were afraid, but the children had said their prayers. Always, the quest for justice draws one deeply into the heart of God, writes theologian Barbara Holmes. Many of the marching children received extensive nonviolence training from their church communities. The strategy of passive resistance was essential to the civil rights movement in Birmingham, as many of us know. One former marcher, Arnetta Streeter, said that we had to sign our name to a form that we were willing to march and that we were definitely going to be nonviolent. It was very, very important for you to understand. If you couldn't be nonviolent, they couldn't use you. The form that each protester signed was the Ten Commandments of Nonviolence that Helena read for us earlier. When I first read those Ten Commandments of Nonviolence, I was struck by their prayerfulness. In fact, only one of the commandments is to actually refrain from violence, right? The other nine speak to meditation and faith and prayer, right relationship with self and community and God, and ethical action in the world. Courage is fear that has said its prayers. The children of Birmingham, Alabama were afraid, yes, but the children of Birmingham, Alabama had said their prayers. In her book, Joy Unspeakable, Contemplative Practices in the Black Church, Reverend Dr. Holmes writes, "The activism that ignited the freedom movements had contemplative practices at their center. The very act of passive resistance can be described as stillness in the midst of turmoil. You cannot face German shepherds and fire hoses with your own resources," she writes. "There must be God and stillness at the very center of your being. Otherwise, you will spiral into the very violence that threatens you." Or as the choir sang earlier, "Nada te torbe, nada te spante. Quien a Dios tiene, nada le falta," right? "Nada te torbe, nada te spante. Solo Dios basta." Nothing can trouble, nothing can frighten. Those who know God shall never go wanting. Nothing can trouble, nothing can frighten. God alone fills us. You cannot face German shepherds and fire hoses with your own resources. There must be God and stillness at the very center of your being. When I am facing large injustices, I find myself inspired by the kids who went on those marches in Birmingham so many years ago. Those kids who spiritually centered themselves enough to face abuse and violence in order to protest injustice. In the face of great evil and when stricken by great fear, we must organize movements of great courage. But what about those more personal fears, those day-to-day existential fears? You know those fears. I'm sure many of you feel them as I do. Will I ever find love again? Did I choose the wrong career? How do I tell someone a truth that I know will devastate them? Will I ever move past this addiction or depression, this illness, this habit that constricts my life and hampers the person who I want to be? Will I ever be able to reconcile with my loved ones? Did I cause irreparable harm to someone I love? Is this all there is? In my life, these questions sometimes show up as gripping fears and sometimes just as aching anxieties. How do we find the courage to face these kinds of fears and anxieties? Well, everyone from Franklin Delano Roosevelt to Mark Twain to Nelson Mandela has said something like, courage is not the absence of fear, courage is the ability to act in spite of fear. But sometimes it feels like the real courage is needed not to act in spite of the fear, but simply to just be present to the fear itself. Sometimes that which we fear is out of our control, and all of our action won't even necessarily give us an answer, or the answer we want will not necessarily be able to resolve all of our problems. If we seek love, we can go on 100match.com first dates and still not find it, still not know if we'll ever find it. If we're depressed, we can try medications and therapies and huge life changes and still not know if we'll ever truly have an easy time getting out of bed in the morning. If we harmed someone in the past, we may never know if they will heal or if we can repair that relationship. Courage in the face of those fears is often just the courage to face those fears. And this was the hardest part for me of today's sermon to write, because like many of you, I'm sure, I struggle to face my fears and to remain present to my anxieties. Even as I reflect on the ways of building courage to face our fears and act in spite of them, my anxieties loom large, and I question whether I have the strength to face them. I often hide in a glass of wine and an episode of Game of Thrones rather than face my fears. But this is what I know. Fear and anxiety, both of which can be immobilizing forces that weigh us down and keep us frantic and stagnant, fear and anxiety also generate energy for change. Fear and anxiety are signals that something isn't right. Something is out of balance or out of sync. Something isn't safe or peaceful or whole. We fear violence because we need to feel safe. We fear loneliness because we want to feel intimacy. We fear failure because we want to feel worthy. And often the only way to eliminate our fear is to muster our courage and confront that which we fear. Whether we need to confront the external force of injustice, as the children of Birmingham did, or whether we need to confront a loved one with bad news, or even just need to confront our own insecurity, we will often only get to the point of confrontation when that fear or anxiety is so huge that it can't be ignored anymore, that it's filling us with anxious energy. Any of you who are my fellow procrastinators out there will know this feeling all too well. We may try hard to complete a task well ahead of the deadline, but over and over again we find that the energy to complete the task only comes when we are close enough to the deadline that the anxiety kicks in. Anybody else feel that occasionally? Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. This is the preacher's weekend experience. Athletes know that sometimes it takes the anxiety of an important game in order to bring out the team's best performance, or so I'm told, as I'm the world's worst athlete. Fear and anxiety arise when there is a gap between that which we know to be true, that which we know to be right, that which we know to be balanced, and that which is right now. We have few options when we face that gap of that which should be and that which is. But there's some good ones. Here we go. Here are our options when we face that gap. We can retreat. In other words, we can decide that it's not our problem, or maybe that we just can't give our energy to it. We can continue to sit in that fear or anxiety. We continue to sit in that uncomfortable tension. Or our third option is for us to muster the energy to close that gap, to close the gap between what should be and what is. We can do that by finding a way to come to peace with what is, or changing what is to what should be. Courage is the energy that it takes to close that gap, and the energy that it takes to close that gap is also fear and anxiety. It's a paradox. But courage is fear that has said its prayers. It's not fear alone. In the words of Reverend Dr. Holmes, you cannot face German shepherds and fire hoses with your own resources. There must be God and stillness at the very center of your being. Otherwise, you will spiral into the violence that threatens you. In other words, what can transform fear into courage is that stillness at the very center of your being. That groundedness, whether this comes through God in prayer or through meditation and mindfulness, or any of the ways that connect us with that which we love, those whom we love. When we are grounded, we know that we are resilient enough to face life's challenges. When we are still, we can trust that others, too, are resilient. When we are connected to that transcendent love that permeates all being, flaws and failures, uncertainties and anxieties can all melt into peace. It has been 54 years, I guess, now, since the Birmingham Children's March, and the tendrils of evil are still tangled deeply into the fabric of American culture, as our Not My President protest leader told us earlier. The huge, snarling dogs of injustice, environmental devastation, and brokenness leap wild-eyed at our throats. We are repeatedly knocked over by our culture's powerful jets of devaluation and dehumanization, and we crouch against the wall, soaked in loneliness and in self-doubt. My friends, if we are not afraid, we are not paying attention. But courage is fear that has said its prayers. Courage doesn't come in the absence of fear. It comes when we find that sacred stillness in the midst of the fear. Will you join me in prayer? Holiness beyond naming, God of stillness and freedom, may the quest for justice always draw us deeply into your heart. Trapped by walls of injustice that seem insurmountably high, hearts beating fast, may we find stillness. Blasted off our feet by jets of oppression, breathless and drenched, may we find stillness. When we are afraid, help us to pray. When fear makes us frantic, help us to find our still, small voice. And may we always be a people of courage. Amen, and blessed be.